forget about my baby. Lord, you know she come around.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Gloria, performed by Van Morrison and Them. Jimmy Page, who played guitar with them, and later with Led Zeppelin, was born on this day in 1944. In this hour, I'm speaking with Dr. Charles Johnson, who won the National Book Award for his great novel, The Middle Passage, and is an award-winning novelist and scholar. And he's here to talk about his newest book, Taming the Ox, Buddhist Stories and Reflections on Politics, Race, Culture, and Spiritual Practice. I asked Charles Johnson how he became interested in Buddhism.
That's a story I've told many, many times. My mother was a very literate woman. She was in three book clubs, and she had wanted to be a teacher back in the 1940s, but could not do that because she had asthma, and you had to pass a swimming test. So she couldn't become a teacher, but she had one child, me, and so I became her only pupil. And our house was full of books of all kinds. I was in a book club myself, you know, in my teens, science fiction book club. And one afternoon I was looking at the books in her library, and there was a book on yoga that had come to the house through a book club. And I kind of looked at it, and there was a chapter on meditation. And I was a pretty bright kid. I could understand the instructions for doing meditation. And so I sat down for a half an hour and practiced what I now know is Vipassana, which the Buddha describes to his disciples at the end of the magnificent Mahasatipatthana Sutra. And it was the most incredible 30 minutes I'd ever experienced in my life as a 14-year-old. I came out of it with a sense of time slowed down. The background noise that's always at the edge of our consciousness was gone. I was seeing without judgment, you know, and without judgment there were no distinctions. Without distinctions there was no desire. There was only a sense of peace. I felt I could be infinitely patient with my parents and teachers and friends. And, you know, I detected within myself not the slightest thread or smidgen of anger or anxiety about anything. And it was a magnificent half an hour, but it also scared me, actually, because I didn't have a teacher. And I'd done this myself, and I wondered, what the hell had I just done to myself? and so I said, I'm not going to do this for a while. I'm not going to do this, because at 14, I felt I would be too peaceful. I would be too laid back, you know, and at 14, I wanted to go out and engage with the world, you know. My passion was to be a visual artist, you know, a cartoonist and illustrator, which I became a few years later when I was 17 years old. You know, I wanted to go out and see and experience things. But nevertheless, wherever I would go to see and experience things, like the martial arts I started with when I was 19 years old, right, and I've been in martial arts since then, a lot of my teachers were Japanese. A lot of the systems, martial arts systems I studied were Buddhist. The system I study and have taught here in Seattle, Choi Le Phut, is named after two gentlemen, Mr. Choi, Mr. Lee, they created it, and Phut means Buddha. It's one of the old Shaolin systems. Or I would be reading literature. And, you know, I read all kinds of literature, not just Western, but Eastern. I would come across a poem by Basho or haiku, and it would be so pure. It would be like a thing found in nature. It would stop me cold in my tracks and make me think again about that meditation session and what does Buddhism, you know, mean. So wherever I sort of turned in the world, I would find myself running up on the Dharma, and it was as if it was a call home for me, a call to look within and not without, a call to look at my own mind and its operations, and to understand those operations better. So, you know, ultimately I just surrendered to it. I spent most of my teens and 20s studying Buddhism academically and Eastern philosophy, Taoism and Hinduism in college. I was a philosophy major, and I had teachers who were visiting scholars, you know, from China, who did a seminar on Taoism. It was very small. It was like six or eight of us. But then again, I studied, you know, courses in Hinduism and read every book I could in translation. I couldn't read Sanskrit then, although I wanted to. But every book in translation. So I read a lot of B.T. Suzuki and Eugene Herigal and you name it, obscure writers from India and China and Japan. And then, after I got tenure at the University of Washington, it was early tenure, after 3 years, I realized I had to learn how to meditate. I had to find a teacher. And I found those teachers here in Seattle and California to just check my meditation practice. And then I took formal vows in 2007 in the Soto Zen tradition.
What does that mean, you took formal vows?
As a layperson, I took the formal vows are the precepts, the 10 precepts as they are called. And you find them, the first five are common to all branches of Buddhism. No killing, no lying, no stealing, no sexual misconduct, no getting drunk. Those are the first five. And you'll find those in the Theravada and the Mahayana tradition. And then there are five more that I also took with Claude Anshin Thomas, who is a mendicant monk and a former Vietnam veteran.
He's been a guest on the show.
Hmm?
Who has been a guest on this program.
Oh, has he indeed?
Oh, yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
No,
yep.
That's wonderful. Claude is devoted to the goal of seeing the end of war in our time. He is a wonderful teacher who travels the world for peace, as you know. But then, you know, the other five are do not elevate self above others, do not dwell on the faults of others, do not get angry, do nothing to harm the Buddha, the Dharma, or the Sangha. And some of those are kind of hard for people to do in the academic and art world, you know, particularly do not
in the real world, just everyday living. In the real world, in everyday living, it's just hard to do.
Yes, it is. Well, if you're an academic, you know, you get points. You score ego points for tearing into somebody else's argument.
Right.
You know, it's a difficult path that you have to walk if you're Buddhist and an academic, to be open to other views, to be open to all views, to try to see the truth that's at the kernel of somebody else's, you know, perspective. But also to be critical. But you're critical, if you have to be critical, I think in a constructive way. The Buddha called that skillful means, upaya kaushala. You're addressing problems in such a way that your approach is healing rather than divisive.
So I want to take another step backwards, if I could. One of the things, and by the way, folks, you're just tuning in, I'm here with Charles Johnson, one of our great philosophers and thinkers, of course, wrote Middle Passage. We're talking about the latest piece of work coming out, Taming the Ox, Buddhist Stories and Reflections on Politics, Race, Culture, and Spiritual Practice. He's got a couple more books coming up in January or so, and we'll be bringing him back for those, too. But we're focusing on this one right now. But I want to take this a step backwards. For just some people, when we talk about Buddhism, I want people to get a sense of what, you know, because it's to wrestle with this issue. But let me talk wrestle with what it means. Let me start with just even the words, some of the words you've used. All right.
OK.
You said the word Dharma.
Yes.
D-H-A-R-M-A. Dharma.
Yes.
What does that mean when you say Dharma? Many people may listen to us right now, never heard of the word Dharma, may have heard the word Dharma and don't know what it means. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Dharma simply means teachings, the teachings of the Buddha. There are three refuges in Buddhism that we go to. One is the teacher, that's the Buddha. The other is the Dharma, or the teachings. And the third is the Sangha, that's the community of Buddhists who support each other. Originally, that meant monks and nuns, okay? That meant monks and nuns. But it's been broadened by many Buddhist thinkers to include, you know, for Thich Nhat Hanh, for example, all sentient beings are part of the Sangha. Or the community of Buddhists. You know, at one time, one-third of humankind was either a student or a follower of the Buddha. It's not one-third now. But as Paul Tillich, the great Christian theologian, said, Buddhism is one of the most competitive religions in the world. And it's competitive precisely because it is non-competitive. It is non-dualistic. I think the important thing to realize is that Buddhism is a philosophy. And, you know, the word philosophy is composed of two words, philo and sophrosyne. Philo means love, to love, and sophrosyne means wisdom. So traditionally, going back 2,000 years in the West, to be a philosopher meant to be a lover of wisdom. And I think it's pretty clear that neither the West or the East has a monopoly on wisdom. Wisdom is to be found in many, many places. So Buddhism as a philosophy, the Dharma, is about wisdom, the study of wisdom, the pursuit of wisdom.
And to be clear, one of the things you also emphasize in different parts of this book and different pieces that you've written is that to practice Buddhism, that has nothing to do with the belief in God. You can believe in God. You don't. It's not to have a belief in God.
You have people who, you know, here in America, you know, everything is either or.
Right.
Very often in the East, it's not either or. It's both and.
Right. Exactly.
So if you go to China, you might find people who have Buddhist practice and a little Taoist practice too. You know, here in America, we have a growing number of people who are Black American and Buddhist. Some of them are celebrities, like Tina Turner or Herbie Hancock, but others are scholars, like Jan Willis at Wesleyan. And Jan often describes herself as a Baptist Buddhist. I mean, I love it when she says, Buddhist practice helps me to realize Baptist principles.
Right.
So you don't. It's not a matter of either or. Now, again, when Christians first encountered Buddhism, some of them, they didn't think it was a religion because there was no reference to God in the literature or, you know, in the speech of the people that they talked to who were Buddhist. So they said it must be a philosophy because there is no reference to God. Well, you know, the issue here is for the Buddha and all Buddhists is how do we end suffering? And we don't need to talk about cosmology. If you've got an arrow that suddenly pierced your body, you're not going to worry about what wood it was made of and what forest the wood came from, you know, and all of that. You're going to find a way to pull the arrow out of your body and to end suffering. And you can do that yourself. You don't need an appeal to a transcendent authority to do that. The beautiful thing about Buddhism is that you really are responsible for your life and the meaning of your life and your own happiness. It is within your power to achieve happiness here and now. And you will achieve awakening one day. It's going to happen. You know, I'm not going to say there's any truth to reincarnation, but if there is, one day you will achieve awakening in one of those lives. I want to do it in this life. Get off the wheel. I really don't want to come back again. No. I want to get it all done in this life and whatever. But that's the beauty, is that you are in control of your own life through mindfulness every day. And there's a lot of similarity between that and the creative process, the artistic process. You know, the artistic process, as I understand it, and I've worked in several different art forms, is about getting yourself out of the way so that the work that is coming into being can exist. You got to get yourself, your ego, out of the way. That's one thing that you have to do. And as Herbie Hancock says, when you're doing jazz, you're not judgmental, you know, of the other musicians playing with you. You take what they give you and you go with it. And so the creative process is very much about giving up a lot of our prejudices and presuppositions and trying to see things with fresh eyes and getting our own ego out of the way. And so you can create, if you're a Buddhist artist, prolifically. You don't label yourself. You don't label what you do. You simply create.
One of the pieces of this book that's so powerful, I kind of read through a bunch, and you just mentioned a moment ago, Jan Willis, an amazing thinker and writer, human being, apparently. Mm-hmm. You explore the notion of why it's time, with this one chapter and many chapters here, why Buddhism for Black America now. But you go through a lot with this. And I think that this is, to me, is a fascinating piece of the book, is just exploring, because you do this in so many of your other works, exploring race in America and exploring it with the how we're so defined by it and how white America is overcome and doesn't even know how much it is overcome by race in America, and your approach to being both Black and Buddhist and why Buddhism could be so important in the Black world.
Yes. Well, that you're referring to the essay titled Why Buddhism for Black America Now, right?
Right, and your Trayvon Martin one and the meaning of Barack Obama and any number of things you've written in here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that essay could be called "Why Buddhism for America Now."
Exactly. Right.
You know, we live in a country right now, Mark, that I think is extraordinarily polarized. We live in a country that is violent. I grieve at the violence that I see weekly in America. And America has a violent history. You could not maintain something like slavery for 244 years and then another 70 years or so of segregation, racial segregation, without systematic institutionalized violence, you know, to hold black Americans down. The violence just permeates, I'm afraid, our history. And many of us walk around, I think, during the course of our day, as Claude Anson Thomas would say, with a war going on inside of us. You know, in the Trayvon Martin piece, I say, you know, that the Malcolm X grassroots foundation, their data says that a black American is killed by the state, by state-sanctioned violence every 28 hours. Every 28 hours. And we know about Eric Garner, right? And we know about Mike Brown. But the point is that violence begins first in the mind. You know, Zimmerman killed Trayvon hundreds of times in his mind. You know, all the Trayvons, hundreds, thousands of times in his mind before he killed him in fact.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things you write here, and this is, let me just read this one piece and kind of jump off from here. This is the, kind of the beginning of this particular essay. It's the next essay, one of the next ones, the mindfulness and the beloved community.
Yeah.
When you write, for black Americans in the post-civil rights period, the systemic undoing of the cultural indoctrination, the conceptual paint we have received from a very decadent, violent, materialistic, and Eurocentric society is crucial for our liberation, personally and as a people.
And
it's just the, I mean, that idea.
Buddhism is not about accumulating. It's about undoing.
Right.
It's about letting go. That quote is that you just read is inspired by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Bhikkhu means monk, and Bodhi means wisdom. He's a wonderful writer and translator of Buddhist, you know, literature. Here's the deal for me. What does it mean to be free? You know, I think if you looked at black American life in this country and you looked for an essence to it, something that is continual from the beginning to now, something essential, you would have to say that it is the desire of black Americans to be free, liberation. And I wondered as a young man, what does that really mean? You know, what does that mean to be free, really free? Well, I don't think it means materialism. I think that's one of the traps that we fall into in a country like America where we are exposed to 3,000 product messages a day. Mm-hmm. Coming at us through all forms of media, billboards, you name it. You know, our iPads, our iPhones. We have to think deeper about what does it mean to be free, really free. So it's going to involve letting go of a lot of ideas that we have received uncritically as a people. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. I mean, because, I mean, if you take that and then, let me read you one more thing you wrote about, something, another piece here, because it just says so much with what America is wrestling with today as I was reading this book. And I really, in many ways, let me just say this to you and to our listeners that are listening to Charles Johnson and I speak right now about his latest work, Taming of the Ox, is that this book, when I was going through it, was almost a meditative practice.
Just, oh, wonderful.
You know,
no, seriously, when I read the pieces in this book, I feel a tremendous sense of peace.
Me too.
After each one. And I felt that when I was writing, the writing of these essays and stories was actually for me a form of spiritual practice. I write a lot, you know, for a lot of different publications.
I said you do, yes.
Yeah, for different publications and assignments. But these pieces and essays were like spiritual practice for me. So I feel that again when I read them. This is my 19th book, and it is a sequel to Turning the Wheel, Essays on Buddhism and Writing in 2003. It's 10 years of writing about the life of the spirit and how we can approach phenomena in the world, right, based on the life of the spirit. And for me, it's one of my favorite books. I love this book.
No.
I thank you for reading it.
No, I love this book, too, and I've read a number of your works, not all 19, but a number of them, and this is amazing to me. And let me just read these two pieces you wrote here at the very end of the Every 28 Hours, The Case of Trayvon Martin. And let me just read this so we can talk about this. You wrote, Bhikkhu Bodhi once explained mindfulness in this way. The task of right mindfulness is to clear up the cognitive field. Mindfulness brings to light experience in its pure immediacy. It reveals the object as it is before it has been plastered over with conceptual paint, overlaid with interpretations. To practice mindfulness is thus a matter not so much of doing, but of undoing, not thinking, not judging, not associating, not planning, not imagining, not wishing. And then your words come next. For white America, this systemic undoing of centuries of racial indoctrination, this letting go of the conceptual paint it has uncritically absorbed about black Americans, is the necessary first step towards the epistemological humility and egoless listening we are morally obliged to bring to our encounters with all others. Another name for such selfless healing, listening, is love.
Yes. If you look at the Bhikkhu Bodhi quote, one of the things for me that happens is I say, oh, my God, you know, this is an early form of phenomenology. In phenomenology, one of the first steps that we do is called the epoche, where we bracket our assumptions and presuppositions about an object that we're studying. So Buddhism has a kind of phenomenological flavor in its early, you know, in incarnation, 2,600 years ago. Now, it's all about being. It's all about being mindful. One of the things we have to deal with constantly is how we impose our ideas upon our experience, how we our presuppositions and prejudices and assumptions about objects and others, and the only way to break free of that is to approach objects and others with an attitude of epistemological humility. I use that phrase. It's really from philosopher Herbert Spiegelberg. And the other phrase I use an awful lot is egoless listening, to listen to the other and see how it or he or she unfolds before us. And we take our cue from that, not from the ideas and presuppositions that we bring to objects and others, but rather how they speak to us, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It does. And one of these things I think is important to think about. I was thinking about the email conversation that we engaged in just before that led to your coming on the program with George Yancey, the philosopher.
Yes.
After the watermelon joke was told at the National Book Award. And the email that you wrote was, and the message in that email, "Why We're So Tired," I think is how you phrased it.
That's the title of a piece that someone wrote.
Right, but and that's why you put on what you put on top.
Mm-hmm.
What it also spoke to me of a kind of a frustration and anger that people can have in this country, and it's often how you as a Buddhist. And as a black man in America, deal with that anger when those things happen. Deal with the Eric Garners that happen every day in America. You know what I'm saying? I mean, and all the things you wrote about the kind of materialistic terror of a Eurocentric Western society, American society we live in, and how we have to work our way through that somehow. But,
absolutely. Well, you know, when Daniel Handler, I think is his name, made the remark about watermelons during the National Book Awards ceremony when Jacqueline Woodson won in the children's category, I felt anger. I've been a National Book Award judge three times. I've chaired that panel twice. And it was so inappropriate, and it was so blind to do that. And to take that moment away from her at that time, I felt anger. But here's the deal. One of the things that's very important, it is very important that we do not fall into the cliche of the angry black man. Okay? The angry black man is one of the tropes that a lot of people, you know, understand black males in terms of. And, you know, anger is, we're going to experience anger, but what we have to realize is that we are not that anger. It passes through the mind. Everything is impermanent. Buddhism is based on the understanding that everything changes. Everything is impermanent. Put it this way, everything dies. That's nations, that's thoughts, that's feelings, that's emotions. They arise in the mind because the mind is all about producing ideas and feelings. That's its job. But if you, in terms of mindfulness and meditation, you can watch and trace your feelings and emotions. And they will rise and they will crest, and sooner or later their energy will dissipate. You do not have to be trapped in the cliche or stereotype of an angry black man. You are not that anger, okay? But if you do feel a positive emotion, or even a negative one like anger, you can take that energy and apply it to constructive action. That's what you can do with it. If you're going to hang on to it or be attached to it, then you can take that energy and transform it into something else. The emotions are nothing more than energy.
I mean, I think the message you're giving in part of this, I mean, when you write about Buddhism and black Americans, write about the black Americans who are Buddhist. That's also very important. The Herbie Hancock piece, that all the things, the people you've laid out for us to think about and why they've taken this path and what it's done for them. But you're also speaking at the same time to all of America.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's because in some ways, the process of shedding the deep-seated racism that inculcates every fiber of every being of every person in this country means you have to go inside to shed that. Can't just be shed by social programs and dialogue. There's something else that has to go on.
This is work we have to do, each and every one of us, on ourselves. We have to look at ourselves critically. We have to look at our ideas. You know, one of the things I constantly find myself doing during the course of the day is an idea will pop in my head, and I'll say, "Now, where did that come from? Was that from one of my teachers? Was that from a friend? Was that from media? You know, that I picked this idea up? And is it true? Do I really believe in this idea, or even this feeling? Why am I feeling this?" And so you constantly examine the processes of your own thoughts and mind and heart. And you come to clarity that way. And you come to understand what really are your original thoughts and feelings and what you truly believe. So we have to work on ourselves. And that's something a lot of people don't want to do, unfortunately, because it's a lifelong effort. It's a lifelong effort to constantly being, you know, self-aware.
And also part of that awareness to me is understanding other human beings in different ways, or part of our history in different ways. And there are many people who run the thread through this book, whether it's, and I'll talk and ask you to talk about them in a bit later, but not like Nagarjuna and
Nagarjuna,
he runs through this book a lot, and Anshin runs through this book, Claude does, but also King runs through this book all through it.
Yes.
And you know, I thought about the there used to be, I heard somebody say once that Buddha was not a Christian, but Christ would have made a great Buddhist. And I thought, though, I switched that around after reading this book and started thinking Buddha was not a black Christian, but Martin Luther King would have made a great Buddhist.
I kind of like that formulation. Well, I would say the Buddha was not a Buddhist.
Right.
I mean, one of the things we do for shorthand conversation is we'll say, "Oh, I'm a Christian. I'm a Buddhist. I'm a Muslim."
Right.
Well, the truth for a Buddhist is that's a label, and it's basically I just try to say I follow the Dharma, and I consider it to be a privilege to be able to engage in Buddhist practice. A privilege. Now, if you look at Martin Luther King Jr., you have a deeply spiritual man. And we sometimes see him basically as a civil rights leader, and that is absolutely true. But there is a spiritual vision of the beloved community that animates deeply King's goals. He was our most important moral philosopher during the course of his 39 years, you know, from Montgomery to Memphis. But we kind of don't pay attention to those things where he challenges us to be better, you know, to grow, to understand others and ourselves better. He says, you know, I can't be what I need to be until you are what you need to be. You can't be what you need to be until I am what I need to be. In other words, we live in a world of interrelatedness and interconnectedness, and that is very, very Buddhist. Very Buddhist.
You had this earlier, but you take a lot of quotes. One of the quotes you have here, and you said Martin Luther King observed in a sermon delivered in 1954, "The great problem facing modern man is that the means by which we live have outdistanced the spiritual ends for which we live. The real problem is that through our scientific genius, we've made a world a neighborhood, but through our moral and spiritual genius, we failed to make it a brotherhood."
Exactly. I think it's one of King's many very powerful quotes. I mean, I love what's going on in the sciences right now. I'm fascinated. I think our progress in America is really in the sciences right now, and not necessarily in the humanities, but I won't go off into that. But one of the things that King is trying to tell us is that in order to have a full life, we must have a spiritual practice. We must. He says that in one of his favorite sermons, The Three Dimensions of Life. You know, three dimensions of life. You have to work very hard as an individual to do the best you can. Secondly, you must work for the happiness and freedom of others. There's nothing greater than to do something for others, King says. And finally, as a Christian, he says, you have to understand that we were made for God. As a theologian, he always returns to that, the divine. So those three dimensions of a complete life, as he calls it, involve our individuality and our collective social life and our life in respect to God. Now, when I talk about King, I isolate in my novel Dreamer three things I think that are very important for him. One is nonviolence, not as a technique just during demonstrations and protests, but nonviolence as a way of life. Secondly, agape, which is supposedly the way God loves man, but what it really is how we should approach each other, an unconditional love, a teleological love. You know, every parent knows that their kid is not lovable every moment, right? There are times when your kid does stuff and you say, what is wrong with your kid, right? But you love your kid,
right.
your child,
right.
And you say, okay, I'm going to stick with this kid because he or she will learn and will change. Well, you got to do that with somebody like George Wallace, too. He's very unlovable in 1955 mm-hmm. and, you know, 1965. But for King, you hold out the possibility that he will join the beloved community. You know, he will awaken to the brotherhood of man. So agape, along with nonviolence, are very important for King. And the third thing is integration is very important for King because our lives are already threaded with the lives of other people. You get up in the morning and you get your coffee and you wash your face and the towel, you know, was made in Turkey and the coffee came from South America, he says. You know, before we even step out the door, we've depended, King says, on half the rest of the world. We don't realize how integration permeates our existence so thoroughly.
That's interesting to say that. I hope this is a bit of a digression, I think, but after what you said and think about the book, I think I have to ask anyhow.
mm-hmm.
Which is that in all these conversations I've been having around race in the last all my life, but especially in the last months since we've come with the Trayvon verdict, Trayvon Martin's, what happened with him, and then and going to the murders by the police. Michael Brown and Eric Garner, there's been a real tenor of when you talk about integration, just the opposite of a separation.
We have in America right now a real degree of separation racially. I think the figure that I've read is that 80% of white Americans live in all-white communities.
Right.
During our earlier conversation, George Yancey pointed out that only 10% of white Americans have a black friend. You know, we're in the same space, but we don't really know each other.
10%.
We don't really know each other. Some people only know black people through media, through television and movies. They've never really encountered in a deep way the racial other. And I think that's a tragedy because our lives, whether we like it or not, are interpenetrated with the racial other. You know, one of the people who contributed to the invention of the stoplight that everybody stops at
right.
is a black American.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Inventor. We don't realize how thoroughly our lives are interconnected to other people. And people have a tendency to collect themselves with people of like views and like feelings and like prejudices, right? Well, that is not how we're going to get E Pluribus Unum. We don't have E Pluribus Unum right now, you know, out of many, one. And that's one of the tragedies of it. But it's also one of the goals, I think, of American society, something we're constantly reaching for. And I think Buddhism, the Buddha Dharma, should be part of that conversation because it gives us a vocabulary and a grammar for how we might begin to approach that and approach others with egoless listening and a sense of epistemological humility.
You know, when you talk about some of the threads, there's so many threads in this book, and I might have to ask for a part two and three of this conversation. But
I'd love to do it.
So, but one of the things that you talk, I was thinking about the piece early in the book about why Buddhism is important in the black world, and I'll just do these phrases. You can talk about them. You talk about impulse control.
Yes.
Then you talk about in another part of the book about why black folks need Buddhism and run through this beautiful piece that you have early on in the book, at least it's relatively early on, about looking within and the importance of looking when the inward revolution of Dalai Lama. And then you talk about why people need to listen to Buddhists of color later on in the book.
Yeah.
And to me, there's a connecting thread there.
What is it?
For me, the connecting thread is, I just want to parse these out a bit, but for me, the connecting thread is because of the pain and the power of this conjured up notion of race that's happened in the last 400 or 500 years in Western world.
Yeah.
The pain is caused in the black community because of the nature of oppression and having to worry every time we walk out the door, you're going to be stopped, as you wrote about in the book, too, and what's going to happen as you hit the street and get confronted by somebody's racism somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
How you respond to that and what Buddhism has to say about that, but also what because of that, mm-hmm. that black folks would come to the notion of Buddhism and what that means in a larger sense, have something to say to the wider world about healing all of that and changing all of that.
I think I understand what you're saying. Well, when you talk about impulse control, that is from the essay, Why Buddhism for Black America Now,
right,
and I'm
right.
quoting George Mumford, a sports psychologist who teaches Vipassana meditation to the Chicago Bulls and Los Angeles Lakers. And what he says is the main benefit for black people living in the inner city is that meditation leads to impulse control. He says the inner city is a pressure cooker full of tension and anxiety. It's easy to go off or to reach for something to ease the pain. Meditation helps people understand the operations of their minds and emotions. It teaches us how to detach ourselves from outside provocation and from our habitual patterns of reaction. Now, that's a very important statement. Because, you know, if you're living in a society with these kinds of racial tensions, you want to be in control of yourself when you hear a stupid remark that someone makes or someone approaches you with ideas in their head about who they think you are. I've got a line in here from a black poet who I've not been able to identify, but I've had it in my notebooks for a long time. The line is, "Must I shoot the white man dead to kill the nigga in his head?"
Right, that's a great quote. Right, I remember that book.
That's the only place that the N-word exists. It's only in somebody's head. And you have to understand this has nothing to do with you, you know, as a human being. You know, and you know that, of course, already. So how do you negotiate those situations? It requires a great deal of self-control and discipline, and the Buddha Dharma delivers that as one of its gifts or benefits.
And early in the book, there's another thread that runs through this, which is this notion of engagement or non-engagement, you know, with society. To me, that's also connected to this. I mean, that you write about some people, Berman and other people who've written Voltaire, talking about the necessity of retreating to your family and community amidst all the madness we're around, which I can understand why people do that. We all do that. But then this, for a lot of people, there seems to be this disconnect. How can one be a Buddhist and an activist?
Well, I don't think those two things are in contradiction if you look at the history of the Buddha Dharma. I think you're referring to the second essay in the book called Dharma for a Dangerous Time.
Yes.
And this is a dangerous time in 2014, just as it was when I wrote that piece a few years ago. How do you deal with these flames that are constantly around us, this polarization? Well, I think that if you look at the history of Buddhism, we have the great example of Ashoka, the great leader, who all of his legislation was devoted to compassion for others. You know, helping prisoners, not seeing them as bad people, but as people who can be brought back into the community, setting up teaching schools for, you know, women and all kinds of people. I mean, Buddhism has a long history of compassionate politics, and it's all based on two things, okay? Everybody wants two things. One is to, is to achieve happiness, and the other is to avoid suffering. If our politics are based on that as our goal, then we as Buddhists can be engaged with the world.
And Buddhists are always engaged with the world. I mean, you write a lot about, another Buddhist leader and philosopher who, last I heard, was on his deathbed, as I read. With Thich Nhat Hanh.
He's very old now.
He's very old, but
I hope not on his deathbed. He was in the hospital. But one of the things that Thich Nhat Hanh did during the Vietnam War was he and other monks in his order went to the aid of people on both sides of that conflict. You know, they didn't judge. They went to the, because suffering is suffering. It doesn't matter, you know, if you're with the Viet Cong or if you're with the other side. And he stood side by side with King in opposition to the Vietnam War. He was very young then, and that was when King was one of the first people to be a major figure to challenge the Vietnam War. He took a lot of heat for that too, because there were people who said, "Well, you're a civil rights person. What are you talking about the war for?" And LBJ was very upset about that because he supported civil rights. And here he's taking criticism for King. Most newspapers just broke King's heart when they wrote about his opposition to the Vietnam War. But Thich Nhat Hanh was there. And since that time, he has been one of the preeminent teachers of Buddhism in the world, along with the Dalai Lama.
He was thrown out of, he had to flee Vietnam, thrown out of Vietnam, and then, and after the North Vietnamese and the National Liberation Front won and the Americans lost the war, then he wasn't allowed to go back.
No.
But what's interesting to me, when I was in Vietnam with a group of Vietnam vets and doing this documentary, his Buddhist temples are all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
His picture is everywhere in temples across Vietnam. He's just... he's almost like, for people, the living patron saint for many Buddhists in Vietnam.
You're talking about Thich Nhat Hanh,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was shocked. I mean, I went to a number of Buddhist temples all through Vietnam when we went to do this documentary and to bring veterans back together with veterans of the other side, and Artists Born of War was our theme.
Mm-hmm.
And everywhere we went into Buddhist temples, there was his picture.
Oh, that makes me feel very good.
Yeah.
I've been to certain countries in the Far East, Thailand and others, but I haven't been to Vietnam, and so that's good news. I like that.
Yeah, it was amazing. So the towards the end of the book here, when you have your reviews and prefaces, and you say going beyond ethnic dualism,
yes,
and you write a lot about someone who you've made me really enjoy now, Jan Willis, Dreaming Me, an African American woman's spiritual journey. The Baptist Buddhist and all she went through as a young revolutionary.
Yes.
And Angel Kyoto Williams, you also bring out in that piece.
Yes, I reviewed two books by Black American women who are Buddhist practitioners. One is Dreaming Me, that is Jan Willis's book, and the other one is, I think the title is Being Black by Angel Kyoto Williams.
Yes, it's Being Black, Zen and the Art of Living with Fearlessness and Grace.
I believe in the California area. Jan is not a teacher; she's a scholar at Wesleyan. But they, you know, these two documents, especially Jan Willis's, you could look at Dreaming Me as a kind of modern day slave narrative.
That's how you put it in the book, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I think it's powerful in just that way. And she says she's still on the path, and we all are still on the path. But it's a very affirmative book. I think it should be read by everybody, Dreaming Me, along with Claude Anshin's At Hell's Gate, A Soldier's Journey from War to Peace.
So talk about, this is a good place to kind of take this for a moment, which is all these things have to do with, in many ways, race and the West, but also with his notion of duality.
Yeah.
And how Buddhists approach this notion of the duality.
Well, we keep touching on this business of race. And you know my position. Basically, I think race is a lived illusion.
Right.
I think we can trace the history of race, where it begins in the Western world, how it's refined over a couple of hundred years. There's a history to theory of race. And some people were not part of the club of whiteness until quite recently. You know, you go back 100 years, 120 years, and you look at the New York Times and the vicious jokes and cartoons that they had about the Irish and Jewish people at the same time. Some people came late to the club of whiteness, okay? So this can be deconstructed, and it is deconstructed in critical race theory and whiteness studies. Race is an illusion, and all of our scientists of any merit have debunked it. It is, people, the way people look differently, that's very cosmetic. And you scratch people deep enough, and you're going to find genetically their connection to other people of other races that they are not even aware of. Just, it's in their genes. It's in
right,
their DNA.
Right.
So race for me is an illusion, but it's a lived illusion. And I think that it's something we have to evolve beyond. It's a political matter, but it's also an enlightenment matter as well.
So, I think it's just this whole, there's so many people who think about Buddhism and call themselves Buddhists, but I think that, and it's kind of catchy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, there's a cachet to Buddhism. Everybody has this kind of fuzzy, I call it fuzzy bunny Buddhism, okay? The Buddhists are just these cuddly people, who never cause any problems. But that's not always true. you can look at the Sangha in certain countries in the Far East and see that it's part of the world, and monks can sometimes get caught up in the political turmoil in their own countries, right? It's in the world. The Sangha is in the world. And so I'm not real fond of fuzzy bunny Buddhism, as I call it. Buddhism is very critical. It's very sharp-edged. It's like, as Gandhi says, it's like walking on the razor's edge. And it's all about understanding desire, as well as your own mind. It's about understanding desire.
And this book is, I think, is one of these things is kind of will make anybody want to go deeper into what Buddhism might mean and what it might mean for the world if we really, even if you're not a Buddhist and don't practice it, but think about.
You don't have to call yourself a Buddhist. Just you simply call yourself somebody who loves wisdom. I thank you so much, really, Mark, for doing this interview. This is a book that. That I care a great deal about, but I haven't seen any reviews yet so far.
That's interesting.
Maybe people don't know how to deal with it or grapple with it. I know one person who's doing a review for Shenandoah, but I think it may be a tough puppy for some people because it's not very much like many books that you get in Black American literature.
It's not. It's not. To me, it's like one of those things. It's, for me, as I when I wrote to you preparing for the show, and I wrote to you saying that the three of the people in the monotheistic world that are dear to me are Howard Thurman, Martin Buber, and Paul Tillich.
Yeah.
And when you read those books, any of their works, you have to wrestle with the book.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I would say, Tame of the Ox, you have to wrestle with this book.
Really? You do?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't realize that because it makes me feel so peaceful.
but that leads to peace.
It's a struggle that leads to peace. And you got me to go back and look at Buber again.
Good.
I haven't read anything about I and Thou since the 70s. But there is wisdom there, and it's a very Jewish wisdom. So no people, no group has a monopoly on wisdom. And Buddhism is very much open to that, to change. Buddhism is the only religion that frees you from itself. All the things we talk about the practices, the precepts that I took, you know, the vows as a layperson or upasaka, those are just like the boat that takes you across the sea of suffering. And when you get to the shore, you don't carry the boat around on your back. It served its purpose. And so, you know, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, you know, the precepts, the paramita, all of that, paramitas, those are just tools to take us across the sea of suffering and make and allow us to be free, even of Buddhism itself.
Well, I'm going to thank you for this book, and this is the beginning of this conversation. We have to come back to it. Charles Johnson's latest work, Taming the Ox, Buddhist Stories and Reflections on Politics, Race, Culture, and Spiritual Practice from Shambhala Press. I just can't say enough about it. So I want to thank you so much, Charles, for being with us today.
Thank you, Mark. This has been a great joy.
On our way to break, we're hearing Bob Dylan's Forever Young, as performed by Joan Baez. Joan Baez was born on this day in 1941.
May God's blessing keep you always. May your wishes all come true. May you always do for others and let others do for you. May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung. May you stay. May you grow up to be righteous. May you grow up to be true.